It's Let's Talk Legal on the Talk Station, FM 107.1. And as we begin the program, this is the first one for 2026. And I'm looking forward to a very interesting year. Obviously, we've got a lot going on in the world, but a lot going on here right in our particular scope of interest. And that, of course, being the legal scope. And with joining us this afternoon, we've got Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins. And as always, to remind you, do not hesitate to give them a call. 252 area code 726-9050, 726-9050, or go online to harvellandcollins.com. And I'm going to be very sincere in this comment. It just starts with a phone call, a simple phone call, no cost. Make a phone call or make contact. 252 area code 726-9050. And with that, Happy New Year to you, Cecil and Wes.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Lockwood.
What a year.
We're glad to be here, kicking, going strong. Let's see, what is today? Tuesday.
Yes.
So we actually opened back up on Friday, which was January the 2nd. And so we are 3 days into it. But Lockwood, our law firm, Wes and I, our law firm has a large practice in the area of estates and trust.
Mm-hmm.
We really are, you know, a trust and estates law firm in many, many ways, just because historically that's kind of where we started. After developing a trust and estates practice, Wes, this was many years ago, you know, probably about 17 years ago,
wow.
Started his litigation practice. And so that has grown and prospered. And so here we are now with two primary areas of very large, you know, Roman numeral one, Roman numeral two, but certainly trust and estates work is a focus, and then litigation in all courts, federal, state, all courts. And then from there, it's more of a matter of what cases within that context of those categories, you know, would we refer out to a firm that might, that like a securities matter, mm-hmm. or an intellectual property patent matter or copyright matter.
Right.
There certainly are still some things that that are litigation related or trust and estates related that we bring in some co-counsel on or just refer the client to a good lawyer.
Right.
Now, one of the areas of law that we one of the things that happens to us at our law firm is that we're consulted. I think Wes had a consult just yesterday again on challenging a will, caveat to a will. And we take these files very, very seriously. And what I mean by that is we want to really not go into the court and without having our facts together,
right.
that they're strong and valid, and that we really feel that there has potentially been a will that has been placed on record that really shouldn't be.
Mm-hmm.
After all, a last will and testament is a document of great integrity in the law.
Interesting.
The court is the clerks of court and the court are hesitant to change the terms or to revoke a will, if you will,
right.
or to alter it in some way, to remove an executor. These are all things that have an extraordinarily high bar in order to make a change, because going into it, the court and the clerks of court wish to protect the integrity of the last will and testament.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with all that said, Mr. Collins has just finished a jury trial just before Christmas that was ongoing, and he prevailed in that case, which is wonderful. We usually do prevail, by the way, Lockwood.
Well, that's because you've done your homework. Well, wait a second. You've done your homework, and you said this at the outset. You're very you work very diligently to make sure that any case you take on has substance and value, yeah. and that you can justify your endeavor. So I
that's right.
Well, that's yeah. that's
so Wes is going to take over here and tell us about that case. But one more comment that might come out in Wes's discussion is that, because I find it so interesting, and Andrew in our office, one of our good lawyers who mm-hmm. works with Wes and myself, is that, you know, Wes will come in from these depositions or from, you know, interviewing a witness or even within the context of once the trial begins about what a witness might say. These cases tend to have kind of a life of their own. Yes, we want to be prepared on the front end, but sometimes, you know, we don't know what the doctor right. records are going to say until we have them. Uh-huh. We don't necessarily know what the next door neighbor is going to say about the competency or the undue influence of their neighbor until we hear it. And so they do have an evolution of, and it primarily usually will center around the facts. And the way in which the facts frame up to build the case. And Wes, I'll just hand it over to you from there. But that is exactly what happened in this case that you just had before a jury, correct? I mean, it's all about the yep. facts. That's all about the way in which they developed throughout the litigation, correct?
Yeah, no doubt about that. You know, when we're talking about, you know, will caveats, we do Lockwood certainly, you know, vet these cases very closely.
Right.
I mean, as we talked about in the program before, I mean, we ask hard questions
mm-hmm.
Of the party who's potentially, you know, challenging the will before we go file a will caveat. But Cecil's right. I mean, we don't always have all the information. That's what discovery is for. That's why we get the medical records. That's why we interview witnesses. And we can't do all these things on the day that we're sitting down consulting and the potential client is consulting with us. It takes months for us to gather these things
mm-hmm.
and see how strong or how weak the case is. So in this particular case, and I feel like I can talk about it a little bit without, you know, going into names, because the case has been tried before a jury. The jury came back with a verdict. So that is done. That is a final judgment, a final verdict that will be reduced to a final judgment by the court consistent with the verdict. So in this particular case, we didn't have basically any opportunity to vet because another lawyer had filed the caveat. And so this was years ago. It took a really long period of time to finally get this case to trial because of the court slowed down with COVID. I mean, believe it or not, this was I think a 2020 case when it was filed. So there was a lot of delay there. There were other issues that caused some delay. But we finally got the case to trial in Onslow County before a jury on, I think it was the second week of December.
Uh-huh.
And so another attorney had filed this caveat, and unfortunately this other attorney had some professional issues and then had a heart attack and passed away.
Wow.
So this person who was challenging the will contacted our office, and, you know, we got involved in the file, and this was back years ago as well, but the case had been pending for maybe a year or so before it got to us. And basically the situation was that the deceased was the mother. The father had already died. The mother passed away in 2019, had four children, and had left our client, the person challenging the will, $1. Okay? And left the rest of the estate a third, a third, a third to the other three children.
Right.
So, of course, Once we get the file, we see that not a whole lot has been done. Uh-huh. And so we jump into the process of getting medical records, developing the case, and it was filed, Lockwood, as a typical caveat. So we look at the caveat that was filed, and we because I didn't file it. I mean, I wasn't the attorney who styled this, so on and so forth. So we see that it's kind of a standard caveat regarding undue influence, lack of capacity, and, you know, that's basically it, saying that the mother, when she executed the will, that she was under the undue influence and lacked capacity to execute a will at the time that it was done. Now, the will was executed, I didn't like this fact at all. The will was executed in 2012, and she didn't die until 2019. So 7-year period of time, you know, that doesn't bode very well for a challenge to a will.
Right.
You know, that's kind of a long period of time for us to say, well, she didn't have capacity, or she was so feeble that she was under undue influence. But those were the facts that were presented, and you know, I probably would have really examined, you know, this potential client if I were the one filing this on that particular issue. Mm-hmm. But be that as it may, when it came to me, it was already filed. So as we moved through the case, you know, we got the medical records after the other side basically fought us on getting medical records, which was just a complete waste of time, effort, and money to fight us on that, because those are relevant in any caveat proceeding when you're challenging capacity or undue influence. Mm-hmm. The medical records were very important. Well, luckily, she did consult, the deceased did consult with her doctor pretty regularly.
Okay.
So sometimes you get these cases, Lockwood, and you just have someone who never went to the doctor.
Right.
And so you don't have the records. Okay, she did, and it did appear as though she had a dementia presentation and some complaints from the son who was taking her to the doctor, which is not my client, the other one, right, of the other children, that she had memory problems. And so the dementia presentation looked like it started about a year prior to the will being signed. Well, just because someone has a dementia presentation, you know, doesn't mean that they do not have the capacity to sign a will. Mm-hmm. Because the capacity to sign a will is relatively low. I mean, you really just need to know, you know, who your children are your natural objects of your bounty, your assets, and how the will operates. Mm-hmm. So that's a relatively low standard, you know, in the law. The medical records were good, and the medical records were bad, because there was information in the records as well that indicated things like, you know, Miss So-and-so has had some memory issues, but she's answering my questions well today. It appears that she's able to make decisions for herself. Well, if you wanted to challenge a will based on lack of capacity, that kind of language isn't really what you want to see, you know, but you have to take it, you know, as it is. But it did appear to us that there were a lot of questionable circumstances with regard to this will. And it appeared to us that what was happening was that one of the children, or maybe more than one of the children, who's not my client, was feeding incorrect information to the mother about the son who was left out.
Right.
Saying that he was stealing from her, and, you know, ridiculous things like stealing, you know, a hair dryer from her. I mean, just things that wouldn't make any difference.
Right, right.
And she was kind of delusional to the point where she didn't know the effect of that. And I think that they probably kind of stirred her up to the point where she was kind of upset with the challenging son, who is my client, but for no real logical reason. And I think that she was upset because of the information that was being fed to her, number one, and because she just didn't have the wherewithal that she had had previously in years before To understand, well, that doesn't matter. It's not a big deal. Or let me just call him about that, right. You know, that kind of thing. Because she was, although she probably did have the capacity to sign a will, she was somewhat weak or feeble-minded compared to how she had been in the past. But man, that's an uphill burden, because that's an uphill climb to prove that.
Mm-hmm.
Because we didn't really have good evidence that one of the sons was actually doing that. We weren't standing there in the room when it was happening.
Right.
So it's just one of those things, Lockwood, that's hard to prove. We think that's what was happening because of some comments that she had made to us, but we didn't know that we had been taken out of the will until she died,
right,
7 years later, and we didn't have good witnesses, you know, to be able to show that there was undue influence. So I wasn't, in all candor, now the case is over now, and I would never, you know, go into this detail on, you know, in a public setting prior to the case being tried,
mm-hmm.
but I wasn't loving that these facts. I knew it was an uphill battle with regard to proving a lot of what we needed to prove. I thought that we probably were in the right, but going to trial before a jury is not necessarily about being in the right. It's being right with the law and being able to prove what you need to prove.
We've got Wes Collins with us this afternoon here on Let's Talk Legal, and we're talking about will caveats and also Cecil Harvell and Harvell and Collins. You mentioned the jury. Are all will caveats, do they go before a jury? That's a real quick question on that.
Yes, if it reaches trial, it has to be before a okay. jury. You can't even waive a jury.
Okay.
Even if the lawyers agree, no jury, can't do it. Has to be a jury. That's one of the few areas in the law that in our state that requires a jury trial. Normally, in a civil context, you can waive the right to a jury trial, not in a will caveat.
Okay.
And that okay. Lockwood goes back to what I said earlier around the philosophy of law and the history, the legislative history of mm-hmm. the fact that, you know, after all, this is concerning an individual's last will and testament.
Right.
One of the most, if not the most important document of their life. And we're just not going to willy-nilly allow clerks and judges and right. other kinds of folks interfere with that kind of integrity. Therefore, we demand that there be a jury.
That's very interesting. All right, I apologize for that interruption. Again, we're talking with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins. We're talking will caveats. Wes, continue. I apologize.
Right, no problem. So going through the normal progression of the case, the opposition files a motion for summary judgment, which we would anticipate they do. And we talked about that on the program previously.
Mm-hmm.
That's a motion for the court to consider the evidence through affidavits, depositions, discovery that's been produced, to determine whether there's enough evidence to go to a jury. And under the rules, that's termed as whether there's a genuine issue of material fact.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So the opposition files their motion, prepares their brief with their arguments in it, and we file ours. Our response, and then we have oral argument before the Superior Court in Onslow County. Back, I think it was probably in 20, maybe earlier this year, into 24, so it was a little while ago. But so we prevailed on part of that and lost on part of that. Okay, so the court found that there was not sufficient evidence to go forward on undue influence. And so that kind of goes to Lockwood. What I was stating a moment ago, we just didn't have good evidence
right.
that there was, you know, meddling to the point where one of these children, for example, at the time that she signed the will, the subject will that's being challenged, was under the undue influence
mm-hmm.
of someone. Because, you know, that's kind of a county is grounded in fraud, that means someone's trying to defraud the process. Well, you know, fraud is not done out in the open. Now, that's just the nature of fraud. People do fraud behind closed doors, so we just didn't have good evidence for that. But, of course, we argued as hard as we could on it and tried to apply the cases that we thought applied. But the court disagreed on that and dismissed that. So the case went to trial on lack of capacity. But in any caveat, the propounder, this is the party that says the will is valid, has a duty to prove the will first. Okay, so that's very important. So we go to trial, and the issues in the trial were, number one, the propounder has to prove the will. That means they have to put on the proper evidence that the will is a valid, attested will. This was not a handwritten will. This was an attested will requiring two witnesses, proper execution, so on and so forth. They have to prove that first, and then the burden, if they prevail on that burden, shifts to us, and then we have to prove that the will is no good for some reason. And in this case, the court limited that to lack of capacity. So that's how the table was set, okay, to try this case. There were some really interesting issues with regard to execution of the will. First of all, this kind of goes back to what we've talked about as far as the importance, the sacred nature of a will, how important a will is. The execution requirements are very stringent. The capacity requirements are not that stringent, but making sure the will meets all of the statutory requirements for execution are very important. Now, in this case, there was no lawyer involved in the preparation of a will. Of the will. A friend prepared the will. The friend came in and testified. It was a notarized will, but the notary was not written correct. It was the notary acknowledgement was like the notary acknowledging her own signature, which was, you can't do that. One of the witnesses, there were two, you have to have two witnesses to the will, and the two witnesses have to be present when the testator, the deceased person, executes the will, or they have to acknowledge the execution of the will, meaning it has to be said by the testator, yes, I signed it. And so these are some technical details. And so one of the two witnesses was deceased, but the law is clear that you can put on evidence through one witness. Like the one witness could come forward and say, yes, I was there. Yes, the other witness was there, even though the other witness is deceased. Okay? So you don't have to have both witnesses come to court on a caveat. You could, if one is unavailable, for example.
Right.
I mean, really, if both are available, you can have one witness testify that both of them were there, I recognize the signature, so on and so forth. So there were some problems here, because normally I think the point that's important to make for, you know, just for people to understand is that normally when you get to this point in a challenge to a will, the process of proving the will is, as I say in sports terms, it's a layup. It's easy. It's not hard. That's a 5-minute testimony thing. It's not difficult, because wills, especially wills done by, you know, competent attorneys, are going to be done properly. And the witnesses are just going to come in and say, oh, yeah, I was there. I was at Mr. Smith's office, and we sat there, and we watched it. The notary was right there.
Right.
And it's easy. Well, because the way in which this will was done, and then ultimately the conflicting testimony of one of the witnesses, which is the only witness who was living, because she changed her story like 3 times about what happened. It became a real question as to whether this thing was executed properly. And I kind of knew it was going to go that way going in because I'd taken the deposition of the person, of the witness. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't sure how bad it was going to be for the other side. Well, on my cross-examination of this other witness, it was bad. It was bad. She was twisted all up and couldn't get her story straight as to what happened. Now, you got to realize, Cecil's right. I mean, the court, the jury, they normally don't take setting aside someone's will lightly. Uh-huh. They don't want to do that. That's kind of not the default. The default is the will is good.
Right.
You got to have some good evidence to show that it's not. And so here we are going through the trial. I think opposing counsel probably thought proving up the will would be a 10-minute, 15-minute process. Well, this thing has drug out for probably 5 hours, if not longer, of testimony and evidence relative to whether this execution was done right, because I made sure as a litigation attorney that I was going to overturn every single stone with regard to the evidence relative to the execution at will to expose any inconsistencies, any problems, so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what a good litigator would do here, to zealously represent the interest of the client. So going through this, I kind of felt pretty good after we got through the evidence of this witness. I felt like that we really showed that there were some problems with the execution of the will. There were some very technical arguments that I spent hours upon hours kind of obsessively researching. Uh-huh. That I was prepared to argue to the court. That's just part of trial prep. You don't just show up and try the case. You really got to prepare for everything if you want to win.
Mm-hmm.
Any contingency. And so here we are where their evidence is done on that. They rest. Okay, so now the question is, did they put on enough evidence to get to the jury? So I move for a directed verdict, which is basically like another summary judgment.
Uh-huh.
During the trial, and the court denied that. So now here we are going to the second part of the case, which is my medical evidence with regard to lack of capacity. Because remember, on summary judgment, the court had determined that undue influence was dismissed.
Right.
So we were only on undue lack of capacity. So at that time, I'm thinking, I don't know if I need to burden this jury with these medical records, which help but hurt.
Mm-hmm.
You understand? Remember what I said?
Yep.
Some of it was good, some of it was bad.
Right.
I'm not sure. So I'm calling my office and talking with my associate attorneys and discussing it with them, getting second opinions, thinking about what I need to do. And I make the game time decisions that we are not going to put on any evidence regarding lack of capacity. We're going to withdraw that claim. And we're going to go to the jury and hope that they think that the evidence of execution of this will is not sufficient.
Mm-hmm.
And they find for us. So I put all my eggs in one basket because I thought that was the best plan, but I cogitated and thought about that a lot before I did that and discussed it with other lawyers in my office who were familiar with the case. So that's where I landed. And in all candor, I won't go into every detail as far as communication with my client, but I prepared him for not winning the case.
Right,
because
I didn't
love it.
Right.
I didn't love the case. And so we go into closing argument, and I'm able to explain that we are not proceeding forward with that because I lack of capacity. Because I don't think it's necessary because they didn't prove their case on the execution of the will.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the only issue. And that was on the verdict sheet. That was the only issue that we gave to the jury. Was the will dated such and such date, the document titled will dated such and such date, executed consistent with North Carolina law for a valid attested will. And then, of course, the court gives jury instructions with regard to what a valid attested will is. Mm-hmm. And so in my closing argument, I'm arguing from the jury instructions, they didn't prove this, they didn't prove that, they didn't prove this. And so long story short, I kind of thought the jury would be out for 30 minutes, no more than, and probably find the will was valid just because it's hard to get a will set aside.
Right.
And so they were out for 2 hours, and they came back with the verdict that that the will was not executed consistent with North Carolina law. So my client wins the case. So what happens then? Well, interestingly, about a week before trial, a previous will was found. Now, this case was pending for 4 or 5 years, so I don't know why this previous will. I mean, we had asked for the previous will for a long time ago, and because we thought there was one, and they right before trial they find one. So the previous will is the will now, and it leaves everything 25% each between the four children. So, you know, that's where we are. Now, another couple of issues is we did mediate the case, and the other side offered zero at mediation. They didn't offer a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then before the jury came back with their verdict, but while they were out, we communicated a settlement offer. And their response to that was not a counter. But their response to that was no. They didn't even get into any negotiations with it. They just said no. We're not going to agree to anything. Well, why does that matter? Well, that matters now because we won the case, and now we have a motion for recovery of attorney's fees and costs, which is not a small chunk of change. And the court will take into consideration that we attempted to settle the case, which would have kept us from having to spend these attorney's fees and costs, a lot of them, especially at mediation when they didn't offer anything. That's something that the court would take into consideration, efforts to try to settle. So now we're in a posture where my client's attorney's fees and costs are going to be paid under 6-21. We have a hearing on that. That will be later on, but the court will make that decision. But it's when you win a caveat, it's pretty rare you don't get your cost of attorney's fees paid if you win. Even if you don't win, if you had reasonable grounds to bring it,
mm-hmm.
you can get your attorney's fees and costs under the statute. And then my client, you know, receives his 25% of the estate, which, you know, going in, he wasn't going to receive anything. So there was $1. There was a lot of strategy involved. Now, I've kind of glossed over things and gone quickly here. This was a 3-day trial, so it wasn't a super long trial. But one of the reasons it was only 3 days is because we dismissed our only claim,
mm-hmm.
being lack of capacity, you know, halfway through the trial. That would add another day and a half or 2 days probably. So that, as we talk about will caveats and challenging wills and having an attorney involved to help you with it and, you know, spend a couple $100 or $500 or whatever it ends up being to have good legal representation to make sure everything is done right, man, that is, you know, ounce of
prevention.
Prevention is worth a pound of cure.
Right.
You know, because in this situation, the entire reason that the will was set aside, I mean, I think that the jury obviously thought that there were some capacity issues as well, because they heard about those in my opening statement as I referenced the medical records, even though we didn't get into those very much. And there probably were some capacity issues, maybe enough to get the will set aside, maybe not enough. But the reason, ultimately, that this will was set aside was because the execution of the will was an absolute mess. And mm-hmm. I was able to expose that.
A major flaw.
Now, yep, another thing that I was able to expose, and I talked to a juror after the trial, which you're allowed to do, that was very important. Something I took advantage of was that I established that the one witness to the will who came and testified knew the notary, knew that the notary was alive currently, knew that the notary was doing fine, knew that the notary was 72 years old. I'd done a background search, so I knew where she lived, so on and so forth. Knew the notary lived 9 miles away. Knew the notary notarized the will. But they didn't call her to court. They did not call that notary to court. They had the one witness who's living. They had an affidavit that had been previously signed from the witness who died. And then the other person who can break any tie with regard to whether this will was executed properly, the notary, who's alive and well and living 9 miles away, they didn't call her to court. Now, the only reason I can come up with why they didn't do that is because her testimony would expose the problems with the execution of this will. Hmm. And that was a problem. That was a problem whatever reason, they didn't call a notary. And so when I spoke with the one juror, he said that made a huge difference.
This goes back to the question I asked a few moments ago about the necessity of a jury and the value of a jury and the work that a jury does. And I say that because a lot of people, you know, roll their eyes when they're called to jury duty, but it is an important duty, as we all acknowledge here on the program. Let's Talk Legal. One other quick question for you, Wes, before we wrap it up. Statute of limitations on a caveat to a will. Is there a statute of limitations?
If it's a will that is filed in common form, like your typical will that you take to the clerk of court, is accepted into probate 3 years from the date it's accepted into probate. That's your statute of limitations. So you have to file it, your caveat, within 3 years. The fact that it took forever for this to get to trial didn't matter because the caveat was pending the whole time.
I got you. Okay. It just had to be filed.
Yes, right. If there is a petition for probate of will in solemn form, which is a little used mechanism for probating a will, then that can be done really at any time. That's like when you're asking the court to probate the will based on just a different standard, put it that way. But it's still, you have to prove the same things as far as it being a valid will, but it's more of a process. Then anyone who has an interest in that can file an objection to that within a very short period of time. It's escaping me what that period of time is. I think it's like 90 days from service. And if they do that, it immediately goes to a caveat. So those are some of the front-end time periods that apply. So, but usually it's almost always
3 years.
Probate a will in common form, and then 3 years from the date of the it being accepted into probate.
Very important story.
So we are very happy that the case went our way. You know, it was a tough case. It was a case where I didn't love the evidence with regard to it. We had to be very strategic in the way that we were dealing with it. I felt good about the fact that, you know, the will, I thought, really had some serious questions because, you know, this lady was very consistent from her 1999 will all the way up into 2012, and that's when it got changed, taking the one son out, based on some things that we think were being fed to her by the other children or child that were not accurate. Well, it just happened to be that she was Johnny on the spot good medically from 99, 2000, 01, 02, 03, 04, all the way up
to 12.
And then it happened to be in 11 is when she started having some pretty significant dementia issues. Well, it seemed to me that that's when someone swung into action and started trying to manipulate her when she couldn't stand up for herself.
Understood.
Now, I couldn't prove all of that, but I didn't need to.
Right.
I didn't need to.
It just goes to show the value and the major flaw. And the issue here is we wrap it up with Cecil Harvo and Wes Collins, and that was Wes Collins talking about a will caveat. The important aspect of this actually is at the front end of the story, Wes, and that is getting a properly executed will and doing so with legal representation, not casual representation.
No doubt about that. I mean, you know, in the thousands of wills or tens of thousands of wills or more than that, that we've done at Harvell and Collins and that are held in our vault system, under lock and key and hurricane vault and all of fire vault and all that, none of those are going to be subject to a successful caveat. Not one of them.
I think that's important.
Not one of them. And that, because they were done properly, and if the person lacked capacity, which we understand what the capacity is required, then we don't go forward with it.
Understood.
Or if there's a question, we gather the appropriate medical information.
Right. If we're concerned.
Right.
Yeah, if we're concerned. So that's the way it works. But this
we're,
one,
you know, on the front end, Lockwood, what Wes is saying on the front end, where you know, there's more than just drafting a will.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's a very serious event. And you know, who is in the room, you know, who's calling you, who's giving the lawyer direction,
right.
Is it the son or the daughter? You know, I mean, you know, what are the conditions of the testator? I know we've got to go. We're way over today, Lockwood. But
this
that's
is
a good thing.
It's a great story, and I think the important aspect of this, to your credit, Wes, is the fact that you saw the whole case. You didn't just focus on just one aspect of it, but you looked at it, I'll use the term, globally, and looked at every aspect of it. And I think that's important. But again, I think the final conclusion, the most important aspect of this is we go into 2026, as people are thinking about setting up their personal estates, find a good attorney. And by the way, I'm just going to close with this comment. Best attorney, Harbell and Collins, and don't hesitate to make that phone call, 252 area code 726-9050, or go online to harvellandcollins.com. Spell out the word and, please, harvellandcollins.com.